Hello and welcome back to the Masonic Roundtable, a weekly program where Masons from around the world get together to talk about Masonic news and opinions in a friendly manner. Let's see. As a reminder, the thoughts and opinions expressed here are solely the opinions of the participants and do not represent any Grand Lodge statements or positions. Make sure you keep your conversations open for the public and on the level. Let's see. To interact with us, you can send questions or comments to our Facebook stream, Hello Facebook, as well as to the YouTube stream. Hello and good evening to YouTube. You know me, I'm John Ruark, formerly past master of the Patriot Lodge number 1957 in Fairfax, Virginia, but I want to denounce that demitted for all my blue lodges so that I can remain active in all the appendant bodies through the rest of the year. I figured it'd be easier if I could just get the demit from all my blue lodges so I don't have to worry about being active in them, but stay active with the appendant bodies. So I'll see you at the next shrine meeting. Let's head over to Jason Richards for his introduction. There we go. Go ahead, Jason.
Oh, there we go. I left myself muted. Good evening, everybody. Jason Richards, past master of Vacation Lodge number 16 in Clifton, Virginia, member of the Colonial Lodge number 1821 in Washington, D.C., and brand new host of the Seven Liberal Arts podcast, coming soon to Stitcher Radio and iTunes near you. First episode dropping next week.
Awesome. Okay, let's see. Headed over to, Mike the Intern. Hello and good evening, Hammy.
Hello, Mike Hambrecht here, Senior Warden, Lodge Education Officer of Lakeshore Lodge, number 307 in Madison, Ohio, and newly affiliated to the Union Kill-Winning Lodge number 4 out of South Carolina.
Excellent, and... let's see who we have next. Robert Johnson, hello and good evening.
Hey, everybody. Robert Johnson here, past master of Waukegan Lodge number 78, current sitting secretary at Space Novum Lodge, host of Whence Came You, and also the brand new host of a Masonic game show called Call Me Hiram that's premiering on Sky One this summer.
Nice. Excellent. And our special guest tonight, you've seen him before, Brother Joe Martinez. Hello and good evening.
Hello, good evening, everybody. This is Joe Martinez. I'm a member of a bunch of lodges. Most notably, I am chartering a new lodge this year in the Republic of the Congo, and it's going to be called Green Beans Lodge number 6969.
Well, you've been certainly busy, and I wish you the best of luck with 6969. So before we get into it, I want to thank all the patrons who've been supporting the show. You've been an awesome part of getting us going into 2021. So thank you again from the bottom of our heart. If you wish to continue to support the show and Masonic education, head over to patreon.com/themasonicroundtable, where you can get some behind the scenes access, a little Facebook group chat with us behind the scenes. I'd love to see you over there. And yes, this is the April Fool's Day episode of TMR. So... don't take any of that seriously. Please promise.
I don't have time for another podcast or anything else in my life.
Or anything at all.
Or anything.
No way I'm trying. Yes. South Carolina is just a little too far out of my jurisdiction.
I'm sorry for my lame one, guys, but Mike stole mine, so I had to come up with
I almost said I was the newest head of the Grand Lodge of South Carolina Committee on Public Relations. But I thought that might be a little too close, though.
But now, this is the shrine episode that we lost. Anyway.
We found episode 200, and here it was the whole time. We just had to look under the couch cushions. So, let's talk about this week's episode. Brother Joe, being an avid reader and super cool nerd, we thought we'd bring him on to talk about, not one, but two books that, how do you pronounce this guy's name? Mircea Eliade? Eliade's books?
I pronounce it Mircea Eliade, so.
I like that better, so we'll go with that.
Okay, let's go with that.
But Mircea Eliade wrote a couple books on the rights and rites and symbols of initiation. And so while we've talked in previous episodes of the Masonic Roundtable about the importance of having a good initiatic experience, why initiation is a rite of passage into manhood, but yet we never really got into what it is and what it contains and what makes up an initiation ceremony. While we want good ones, what does it look like? What are the facets and frameworks that come into initiations? And so Joe is going to help us break down. We'll start the conversation and see how it relates back to Freemasonry and other cool places and societies that we may be in. So why don't you, Joe, give us a little overview of what are the pieces and parts of initiations?
Sure. And again, thanks for having me tonight. And let's get started. So there's a couple of folks that we're going to focus on tonight, and I think everybody here has read at least one or two of them. You've got Eliade, right, who's written a lot about initiation from a anthropological and a sociological perspective. But then we've also got Arnold Van Gennep, who also wrote a lot about initiation and more specifically rites of passage. So I guess where we could start is what different kinds of initiations are there? So one of them is obviously rites of passage, and everybody here on the panel and also the folks that are listening probably have been through a rite of passage. But then we've also got those vocational types of initiations, right, where they talk about joining a particular vocational type of institution, like a priesthood or something like that. And then we've got the third one where it's basically coming of age rites of passage, whether you're a boy or a girl. There are rites of passage in both ancient and modern cultures that take you from being a child to being a man. So that's the different kinds. And Eliade goes into lots of detail on, you know, their purpose and their meaning and their history.
Yeah. And so for those who haven't really gone back and looked at those other earlier episodes of why have initiatic processes, I think we can vamp for a little bit here and talk about, you know, the importance of having a transition, if not into manhood or adulthood, but also into separating yourself from society in general. And so just in broad strokes, I will start off with the transition into manhood that, we had throughout most of American history, right? You had the, you know, as soon as you were out of high school, you went into the workforce right away. You were kind of out on your own. It was not common to go back and live with your parents. Like, you were an adult pretty much at 18. And that was an eye opener for a lot of people. And then, that's where you make it or break it. It really was not, at least in the recent years, something that you had your hand held along the way. And so as time progressed into a more modern era, with the economy being, you know, where it is, it's now that line is getting a little bit wider, it's getting a little bit grayer. And so really we're having a whole culture, a whole generation, I'd probably say from Gen X on, that have now had a much more, they had to feel their way through life. And so we didn't have these cultural rites of passage. And so that's one thing that I know everyone on this panel enjoys about Freemasonry, is the fact that there is a process, there is a set of steps that one goes through, and they are different when they come through in some way, shape, or form than when they started. Anything you guys want to add to that?
Well, I mean, you see it.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, you see rites of passage in, you know, things as mundane as getting your driver's license, or for guys, you know, learning how to shave. Yeah, you have your dad who teaches you how to shave, or somebody teaches you how to drive a car for the first time, and so. We as human beings are built to absorb rites of passage as marking the transition from one stage to the next in life. You see this in Jewish culture with bar and bat mitzvahs. It is a a passage and an ordeal that doesn't necessarily have to be taxing mentally or physically, but it is an ordeal that is memorable to mark passage of time into a new phase in your life. And so, taking that, from the banality of just growing up to something much more when you talk about spiritual awakening and initiation into mystery schools, I think there's, initiatory rites are just very, very beautiful. And there's something in the human condition about us always striving to be more, to be better, to be different. And one way we do that, and really a big way we do that, is through initiatory experiences and rites, even if we don't know they're being performed.
I think there's an absolute ton of truth in that. When I look at initiatory rites, and I know Joe's probably going to go into this, but we look at tribal initiations and rites of passage, even that exist today in countries where they don't have the technological advances and first world problems that we seem to have. And what it kind of comes down to is, like this idea of trust, even the propagation of a way of life by putting somebody through something that essentially brings them into a fold of like a social contract of the, niche group that they're a part of, or, in a wide obtuse form that we're, like Jason had said, even getting your driver's license, right? That is a rite of passage, or a 16th birthday, or whatever the case is. And those we just take for granted.
But my super sweet 16.
Exactly. And so I think what initiatory rites, in terms of like perhaps the niche, right, of, clubs or things of that nature, specialize and enhance trust and those kinds of things. But yeah, it is a really interesting concept.
So Joe, would you add to that, or would you even extend that into, what makes up these rites of passages?
Right. Absolutely. And I think Jason hit it exactly on the head when he called it an ordeal, right? Because your original or tribal or your ancient type of initiations were exactly that. They were ordeals. So to your point, a bar mitzvah is a lot different. And I grew up in New York, so I went to lots of bar mitzvahs. Is a lot different than leaping over a wild bull, or, if you were a Spartan child and you had to go on a hunt on your own, and that was a symbol of manhood. So, we're talking about things like getting your driver's license now as a rite of passage, versus you would go out, and if you didn't die, you came back a man or a woman, so a lot different, and, the price to pay was a lot higher, but great point talking about an ordeal. But, in terms of all these different types of initiatory practices that we were talking about, there's three phases, and that's probably the main subject of tonight. In anything that's considered an initiatory practice, you have the three main phases. The first one is separation. And then you have, that liminal phase, and we'll talk about what that is in a minute. And then you have that reintegration phase, or is that incorporation phase. So those are the three primary parts of any initiatory rite. Now, for those that are Freemasons or members of other esoteric groups here on the phone or on the YouTube, sorry, I just said phone.
You would have gotten listening to the podcast on their phone.
They could be. Right on. For those of you that have experienced something like the craft degrees in Freemasonry, you would have gotten these little bits at different parts along the journey, right? It's not as linear as it was traditionally back in the past, right? So that separation phase, and then that in-between phase where you're between two worlds kind of thing, and then that reintegration phase where you're brought into a new group, that is what highlights all different types of initiatory practices, all the ones that the guys here discussed. So those are the main important parts of initiation. And those differentiate initiation from those other things, like getting our driver's license or having a Sweet 16 and things like that. So
I like that. Do you want to go even deeper then and really start to walk through like the separation phase and all that and really just kind of unpack that and give us some examples of what that looks like when done well, or how we may have seen that done?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first one, the separation phase, Van Gennep called it the preliminal phase. And he used the word liminal in all of these because the word limen in Latin means a threshold. So it's before you reach the threshold, as you're sitting on top of the threshold in between two places, and then your postliminal phase, where you're over the threshold. You know, those who read Cloudy books, you would have seen the word threshold pop up 100 times, right? So let's talk about that first separation phase. In rites of passage for manhood or womanhood, you know, going from child to adult, that was a big deal in a lot of tribal cultures and your ancient cultures, because there was a huge distinction between adults and children. And once you were coming to the point where you were going to become an adult, there really was a huge separation between your old life and your new life. So that was an important part, that separation. If you read Eliade's books, and he talks about really amazing cultures all over the world, and he actually did a lot of study on some culture, tribal cultures in Australia, you know, that have been doing the same thing for over 20,000 years, right? Unlike, you know, what the Europeans did in South America, where they Europeanized everybody, right? These people have not been touched, they've not been altered, so they've been doing the same thing for thousands upon thousands of years. And one of the things he noted was that separation phase was, it was an ordeal. It was painful, right? This was, you know, I'm no longer going to have my mother treat me as my mother anymore because I'm going to be an adult now. And my siblings, who were all younger, I'm not going to be able to interact with them the same way. It really was a break in the person's life to where this is my old life. I cannot be a part of that old life anymore. Now, in modern initiation systems, especially in Freemasonry, we do have an air of separation, right? We separate ourselves from the world around us and, you know, the trivial things and stuff like that. And we could talk about that further. But, you know, it's a huge difference between, again, no longer being able to go to your mom when you're sad versus, you know
doing other things. Just to add to the conversation, one thought that I've had, too, is with COVID, like, there is no separation, right? You can't go as freely as you'd like. You can't easily separate. And so I'm thinking of what comes to mind is how, you know, school is virtual, church is virtual, like what were sacred spaces are now in your home. And unless it takes, I would argue, double the effort to create separation when you're trying to do work from home, right? Because, I mean, the stats say that, you know, people working from home went up to like 40% of the workforce over the past year. So not everyone, but those who are had to, you know, there's no longer a long commute. It's from upstairs to downstairs, you know what I mean? And so we don't have that separation of I can leave work at work, I can leave home at home. Now they're together. And if you are trying to... But go ahead.
But at the same time, I'll argue that there is at the same time so much separation from everyone and everything.
Yeah. Well, so I see where you're going with that. My point was, is that if you are trying to take a degree, you know, take an online degree, if you're trying to get your work done, right, then that separation, that transition is much harder to do. So, but then once you're there, to your point, it's not the same once you are post-liminal.
So,
go ahead.
With, you know, with COVID and working from home, you know, I've been working fully remote essentially since March of 2020, and I changed companies and jobs in the middle of that. Mm-hmm. I haven't met a single one of my coworkers at my new company.
Wow.
And I've been there going on 6 months. And so there, I understand it's very difficult to compartmentalize. and have your life and your viewfinder that is inactive. I really need to fix that.
Yeah.
Have your life away from Zoom and WebEx and your work. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there is so much separation because we are here in our homes, in our bubbles, and we generally just can't get out and spend that time face-to-face fellowshipping that really getting to know people that we did before COVID.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I was going to ask Joe about, as you kind of mentioned this, I'm a big reader. I know Hambrick's a big reader, not just in, you know, philosophy and whatnot, but fiction. And something that immediately kind of came to mind, maybe it's just because I'm a child, is Peter Pan. And the way you talked about this separation, this forced separation, right? I kept thinking about Wendy having to move out of the nursery and like this huge psychological break that ensues, arguably, right? That this retreat into Neverland, if you will. I don't know, just for thoughts, just to throw it out there, I wanted to mention it.
No, absolutely. And that's a really fantastic example of that separation phase not going well, right? Because the point of separation, at least in initiation, is you're doing certain symbolic behaviors that show to everyone you're detaching from your old group, right? So it's not a hidden thing to that niche or that crowd, right? You're doing certain things in an overt way to say, I am no longer part of this group. I am wanting to join this group, right? But you got to get through the whole initiation part first. So, I mean, Peter Pan itself is a psychological study of retreating in the opposite manner, right? I don't want to leave that old life behind. In my retreat is my childhood, you know? So, but, you know, we can psychoanalyze a lot of people on this call and, you know, get to some good juju, but I will digress on that.
But if you take the Peter Pan symbolism there and the idea of the, you know, of the nursery, you can actually apply that same thought to initiatic experience of COVID. Because we were forced to separate ourselves and to move ourselves into a new environment. Granted, it wasn't a group. It wasn't a, you know, it wasn't a community, but it was a new,
way normal
of doing things. Yes. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So, I mean, it's just along that same, I mean, it can be, you know, because it, you know, on top of the fact that in some aspects that change, especially if you're thinking about children and going to school differently, can be a somewhat traumatic event. Actually once it goes back, in some cases that may even be more traumatic. So just thought.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's then talk about after separation, what we have, the liminal phase.
Yep, absolutely. So that I'm standing on the threshold part where we are no longer part of our older community, but we've not completed the rite of initiation and are members of that new sect or subculture or subgroup. So we're in that in-between phase, right? That kind of between life and death phase, if you want to get, you know, totally metaphysical with it. Those of you who've gone through the craft degrees, you know, if it was done well, you would have experienced that in-between phase. Like, I have no idea what's going on right now. I don't know if I'm going to go all the way. I know I've seen things that, you know, no longer allow me to go back to my old life. So I'm kind of stuck at the crossroads there. For some of those tribal cultures, again, going back to Jason's example of an ordeal, this was a thing like, oh, I'm probably going to die. And, you know, if I don't die, great. I move on to the next part, you know, of this game show called life. But, it was much more, life-threatening than it was, than it is nowadays. Right. I say this having a 16-year-old who thankfully has not gotten her learner's permit yet. So, because she wants to take her time, which is fine with me.
Absolutely.
But, yes, indeed. But yeah, no, it's supposed to be an ambiguous phase. And if you read Eliade, he talks about how ambiguous and how frightening it is for people because they don't know what's going to happen next, but they know they can't go back to their old life. So that resonates.
So I could see some examples of that, of you know, like say for those people who go to college but don't finish, right, don't matriculate. So they've already separated. They have physically gone to the university or something like that. But for whatever reason, can't figure out their major, can't figure out what they want to, you know, just how to fit in this new society. And while going backwards is always an option, you know, if they really don't complete their degree, then they're really kind of left unfinished, right? So I could see
it's
where...
It's kind of in limbo.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like all the student debt.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
the benefit.
I can certainly relate to that. I was certainly one of those people. I left college and joined the Army because, you know, my crossroads point was, this isn't really working out for me, so I'm going to go do something else. And, yeah, I mean, I didn't finish college until I was my bachelor's. I didn't finish my bachelor's until I was 34 years old. So, you know, I definitely, that was a crossroads point for me and a really poignant example. But yeah, to your point, I couldn't imagine, you know, being someone nowadays with, you know, $100,000 in student debt and no degree. It's like, what am I going to do with myself now? You know, I'm going to get a telemarketing job and talk to people about their car warranties for the rest of my life. So, you know,
food service industry.
Hey, have they reached you yet? Because they've been calling me to try to get you an extended car warranty. So if you could just close the loop on that, that'd be great.
Love all those calls. They're my fave.
Yeah. And so is there anything else special about the limbic phase, about like the transition, either after separation or before the post-limbic phase?
So it's definitely not the limbic phase. Sorry, I think you were reading Grey's Anatomy or something before this call.
I was thinking,
not that.
Not the limbic brain.
Yeah, it's that threshold phase, right? And again, every time I read it, especially in Eliade's first book, he talks about that ambiguousness a lot, but I keep going back to those cloudy books, right? I'm on the threshold. That was the first little pamphlet I ever got when I joined the craft. And when I joined in Maryland, they were still giving out the paper, you know, the little paper cloudy pamphlets, right? But on the threshold. And I remember I was reading that thing for about 2 weeks. It was only like seven or eight pages, but I read it over and over again just to make sure I knew what I was doing. But that, you know, things like that really talked about, hey, this is something new. You've not experienced something like this before, whether you know it or not, and it's going to lead you to something new. So I always found that super interesting. But again, we've watered down the process, again, from not wanting to die to, you know, I'm afraid to go back to that old life, which I guess is good, right? Because death is bad.
Growth is natural. Change is inevitable.
Don't fight it. All right. So then finally we get to the third phase, which, remind me again, what's that called?
That's the post-liminal or
liminal. That's the one.
Reintegration or incorporation phase.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
It's after you get the thing out of the laminator and it's nice and durable and you can't tear it.
Smells
or get
good.
It wet.
It's post-laminated. Yes.
Yes, it's a post-laminated phase.
And what's special about that phase?
So, again, talking about initiation, and this is what separates a little bit from, again, getting my driver's license or having my Sweet 16 party. It's that there is symbolism around that phase, right? Leaving the threshold and now coming into that new section of society. And you've left that life behind. So ritualistically, you're exemplifying that, right? For Freemasons, you know exactly at what point in the ritual that old life has died and you've come into a new life. Every single one knows that. Or if you're part of another sort of initiatic order that does that, there is that break phase. You know, for us, it's told with a certain allegory, but there's lots of allegories that tell that same story. But you've completely separated, and now you're reintroduced into society with that new state of being. Going back to the ordeal example that I keep going back to, you know, if you were, you know, in one of those tribal cultures and you did have a rite of passage into manhood, nobody acknowledged you with that old life that you lived anymore, right? You are now this new person, and you were acknowledged as such by your family, by your peers, peers that you weren't allowed to interact with anymore, new peers that you now had. So it's a really hard break between, you know, the first two phases and the third, because now you're that new person and you're supposed to act a certain way and have a certain set of skills or knowledge to take with you.
It's like becoming an officer.
I was even going to go.
I met in the military.
Oh, okay.
Moving from enlisted to officer.
Yeah, right. You're not supposed to fraternize.
Right. See, that always reminds me, again, one of my favorite like paraphrases of an old Mark Twain quote, which in apply to Freemasonry, is that you become a Master Mason twice. You know, once when you're raised, and again when you find out why. Because there are people who have become Master Masons but have not completed the mental thought process that goes with that, right? That they've not been changed by the process, I'll put it that way. Instead of the same guys that will, you know, be the same way they were pre-initiation. And again, we've talked about if it's there for social purposes, that's great, right? But there should be something with the mysteries of Freemasonry that's different than the elks, the moose, whatever, that has you get to that post-laminated phase, so that way you are a different person on the other end.
And that's the limbic phase that you're talking about. That's a really systemic comment that you made, and you know, I don't want to go off on a tangent on how we do things, but we do a generally poor job at that as Freemasons. And I'm speaking on my own opinion.
I'd agree.
Because if the change has not been so dramatic for both the initiate and the initiator that you see this person in a completely new light, then you've done something wrong, right? You've either just read a script and mumbled through it, or you walked the steps, but you didn't really understand what you were doing or care. But I mean, that is that break point there for at least Freemasonry. And again, if we're not doing this, if somebody doesn't walk out, and you guys have talked about this many times, if you didn't walk out with, holy crap, that changed my life, and these guys look at me different now, and I look at them differently, then you didn't do it right.
I don't want that class.
Hammond, you got to work on that cough. It's
yeah.
You're coming down.
Some Robitussin BS on that right there.
So let's unpack that, because I think that is an interesting thing. It, while all good intentions are put into one day conferrals or one day classes or blue lightning, whatever you want to call it, obviously something is sacrificed when, because you don't have those three phases necessarily. One could argue for it to say that we're just taking the 3 degrees and you're still having a separation and then, the reintegration as part of the end of the day. However, there are other pieces of the process that are shortened, quickened, adapted, that really start to, I wouldn't say lessen the experience, but lessen the experience.
They take away from the fact that you don't actually get to experience it, because it's the experience of watching Star Wars. Yes, it's wonderful, but you're not Luke Skywalker, you know, where when you're really going through the degrees, you're Luke Skywalker, you know, you're shooting the Death Star and blowing it up at the end, you know. You're there getting your hand cut off by this man and now suddenly tells you he's your father, you know. Yeah, well, you know.
Spoilers.
You know, it's, yeah, well, you know.
No, but that's a good point.
Hey, I didn't go into Kylo Ren actually, you know, living through killing his father. Anyway, though, the point I'm making, though, is, you know, you can sit down and watch those, and it's a wonderful experience to do. But it's not the same as if you were playing the part, which is what you do in our degrees. You are the center of attention. You are the star of that play. You know, I mean, ritual, but it's still a play. So
it's a drama, right? And it's meant to be imparted as a drama, where exactly as Mike said, you are the star of that dramatic play, right? And you know, anytime somebody has this conversation with me, I say, you know, I've never read anything about ancient Egyptian mystery schools or the schools in Greece, like Eleusis and the Pythagorean schools, where they had a one-day class advertisement. You know what I mean? It was always the exact opposite, you know, and it sounds funny, but it's not. Even, you know, if you go back to like the Eleusinian mysteries, those rites were an entire season's worth, right? It was not just a one-day thing. You went, you brought all your crap with you, you brought a ton of food, you lived there for a little bit, and every person experienced it on their own, right? And then when they got to the Greater Mysteries, which we know was a dramatic play, so, you know, at least Freemasons can have some sort of analogy there, right? Every single person was a participant in that drama. You know, it's not, you know, we're going to take the best looking dude and everybody else sits on the sidelines and watches, because exactly to Mike's point, you're not experiencing any of those initiatic phases watching from the sidelines. You know, does a one-day class make a bad Mason? No. We make bad Masons by our actions. So, or our indifference. So,
right.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not criticizing the Masons made that way. Not at all. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I know quite a few that are in great shape. So
there is something to be said, though, the way those things went out, though. They had the added benefit, I think, also. In a lot of cases, I think things were, like, people did just watch a lot of those plays. And they just got really, really high beforehand.
Yes.
Which sucked them into it, right? Which was a literal changing of brain chemistry, it seems. You know, I can't say we don't have that. We don't allow that.
Not anymore.
P.D. Newman.
They call that hazing.
Yeah, P.D. Newman talks a little bit about some of this idea of perhaps some of the
The fun entheogenic stuff.
Hallucinogenic embellishments and enhancements to the early, you know, 18th century Masonic ritual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little DMT.
Alchemical transmission.
And so, I mean, even without organizing it around a system of initiation, you know, those alone produce wildly different results. You know, once you get on the other side of, you know, some of these ethnogenic experiences, right? So that's kind of the big separation. We've had P.D. Newman on and talked about, you know, DMT and those transformative experiences. They are there not to get you high, but to have an awakening. And most people who have, you know, had taken DMT, LSD, those kind of things have had a different viewpoint of the world, which is back to that transformation and reintegration aspect that you're talking about. They see the world differently after that. They weren't just there for the fun trip.
You know, too, if they actually do the degrees, the rituals absolutely well, and, you know, you're prepared right, your body chemistry produces some of that for you anyway, you know, because there is, I'm not going to go into detail, but there's feelings that you will experience going through your degrees, you know. You can't avoid it if they're done right.
And even if they're done a little bit wrong, as long as that emotion's there, right? As long as people are emoting and actually are putting their energy into it, there is a transformation. And you can tell, especially in something as shrinking as Freemasonry is, right? Because we know, you know, for every two that go, you know, we get a new one. So we're on that downward spiral. But you can tell you walk into a lodge room and you're a stranger there, you can tell who are those that actually went through the process both internally and externally, and those that didn't, right? That are just there for the coffee and the crumb cake. So you can tell who those people are pretty quickly. And so again, it's maybe if the ritual wasn't spot on, you know, the candidate's never going to know unless you were just a complete whack job. But, you know, if that emotion transferred from one person to another, they still get that same feeling, you know? I've seen it happen to people. To your point, I've seen, you know, I've seen one-day conferral Masons who picked up a lot of the stuff after and became better Masons for it. So through no fault of their own, you know, they persevered and, you know, didn't go along with the statistics that John likes to point out all the time. So it really is an overall experience, right?
Call me Debbie Downer.
Yes, you are.
Hashtag 2040.
So, okay, as we mentioned in the chat, the Grand Lodge system is going to implode well before 2040.
It's not sustainable.
Not an April Fool's joke.
and the Scottish Rite Northern Masonic jurisdiction will take over.
Thought it was Southern.
Which one has more video degrees?
Oh, that's
NMJ.
That's an interesting conversation.
Which one has more dollars?
NMJ. Which one has more members per capita?
No.
Anyway, back to initiation.
I like this.
So then now, how does this trace back to Freemasonry writ large? Because we are an initiatic society, right? We are separate from, again, like we said, other fraternal organizations, other civic organizations, because sometimes. Because we at least on record have a ritual that may or may not be followed perfectly to the T, but we do have some sort of ritual that enables those three phases of initiation, by the way that they're documented. Is that, would you agree with that, Joe?
Yes, I think that was definitely their purpose in the 17th and 18th centuries, right? Because, you know, those gents did not get together to just shoot the breeze and have coffee, right? The whole putting together of elaborate rituals and the allegory behind it and all the hard work that went into it had to have a deeper purpose, right? Have we kind of changed that over the years? Absolutely, right? Some through our own fault, some through society's fault. But in general, the purpose of Freemasonry when it started was to take men and, you know, depending on your jurisdiction or other folks, take folks and put them through a process of initiation, which absolutely included separating them from their old life, putting them on a threshold point to make that decision. Do I want to go forward? Is it of my own free will and accord? And then taking them through that post-liminal phase or that reintegration phase where your old life died. You're not that person anymore. And if you still act like that person, then you really didn't understand the whole purpose of initiation to begin with. And you're now this new person and we expect you to act like it.
So what can... Yeah. Oh, go ahead, RJ.
Kind of answering there, that's all.
Oh, okay. Because really, then the next phase of the questions is, well, what can or should an individual lodge or even the Grand Lodges do to kind of get us back to what the original intent of the 1700s, right, purpose of Freemasonry? Like, how could we focus more to get to the intent of the three phases of initiation?
You really are looking towards getting me in trouble tonight, aren't you? So,
this is being recorded and sent to the PR committee, so stand by.
That's fine. So in my opinion, and no one else's opinion, I don't know if the system, the way it's designed right now, can purely get us to that one thing, right? Because Freemasonry has become so many things to many different people, it's kind of hard to put that genie back in the bottle. You know, for some people, you have a guy who's 85 years old, and from day one to day today, it could have just been a social club for him. That's all he's known. That's all he's experienced. And for him, that's what makes Freemasonry right. And there's been arguments about this on social media about it. I was part of that argument. But I'm definitely learning to see the forest for the trees in that argument and say, well, if that was right for him, is he wrong? No, probably not. does he have the capability to learn or change? That, I think, for me is the crux point, right? You know, do you have the ability to incorporate more information? Because if you did, then you really gave a crap about what the degrees meant when you were going through it, right? No matter how Freemasonry turned out for you later in the future. You've got folks that think it's just purely a charity, right? And I've joined a group to just be able to give because I want to give. That's fantastic. But again, if you're doing it from a place where the degrees meant nothing to you, then you're giving for simply giving's sake and not for the ability to transform people's lives. Right. And then we've got those of us that think that we actually are a mystery school and our purpose is to change people's lives forever. All aspects of our lives through a process of initiation. And the reason why I said the system, the way it's set up is not built to fix it is because I think the purpose of things like Grand Lodges are to be that administrative arm to manage and oversee what lodges do, right? And to make sure they're not doing weird, crazy stuff and to make sure they're paying their bills and to make sure they're paying their taxes.
Administrative.
And things like right. Administrative things, right? So, you know, I think to answer your question, I think each individual lodge needs to sit down and decide what is my identity? And you can have all different kinds of identities because then that gives the individual Mason the ability to pick and choose what kind of Masonry they want to practice, right? So, hey, we're just going to be a social club lodge and we're not going to do anything super duper deep and that word esoteric is really gross to us. Fine. Get together, go do something, be your own little lodge and succeed, you know? But if you are someone like me who, you know, goes to lodge for education or goes to lodge for esotericism and things like that, you know, for the more hidden things in our craft, get together, unionize basically, and make that lodge what it is you want it to be, and then go forth and succeed. I think that's the only way it's going to regulate, you know, your scary numbers that you put out once a year. I think that's the only way they're going to normalize is, you know, everybody finds their own identity and just runs with it. And I'll do my thing over here and you do your thing over there. And, you know, if we get together for a barbecue, awesome. But that really should be the type of interactions that should be happening.
With the caution.
An esoteric barbecue?
Yes.
Absolutely.
With the caution to not be overzealous, right? Because we've heard lots of stories over the years of, you know, traditionally TO lodges that are traditional observance lodges that, you know, started being so isolated and so, you know, churning away of others that it became, you know, it became detrimental to them and the fraternity as a whole. So, as with everything, life is a balance, but I'm with you there.
To that point, I mean, listen, I know observant Masonry gets a bad rap. You know, I'm definitely a proponent of it. For especially a lot of the symbolism and a lot of the ritualistic importance and a lot of the solemnity that usually observant lodges place on things like that, right? It's not a hee-haw show where everybody's, you know, shooting the breeze and talking during degrees and stuff. But I will say this, I think it comes to packaging and marketing, right? Which Freemasonry is absolutely horrendous at. But if I'm a new person and I walk into an observant lodge, I should know that this is the flavor of Masonry that's going on here. And if it's not for me, I should probably go somewhere else. You know, I should walk to a lodge that maybe is not observing those practices and has a great social interaction. And, you know, family members are there every night of the week. If that's the type of Masonry I want to do, I should probably go over there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm definitely a free market Freemason, right? That you can say, if you're not getting the experience you want after you've become initiated, cool. Like, vote with your feet and go to a lodge and pay the dues for the lodge of the experience you want it to be, whatever that is. Like, again, we're not saying one is better than the other. We're saying there's going to be an experience that suits you the best. And just because you have a connection with a lodge, your mother lodge that you went through, doesn't mean you have to stay there forever. And I'm guilty of it. I will be the first to say that I paid dues to my mother lodge for many, 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 many years, and never attended because I was busy with other lodges and so forth. And so it's an emotional connection, and yet you have to go where your Masonry is, and it's still easy to do, right? So don't feel guilty. It's not a permanent breakup. It's just a see you later.
On my third lodge in 5 years, so you know, I mean, I had to find, you know, the right place. So yeah, it's not a, you know, not a strange thing.
Right, but to that original point, there, the system has to be designed so that people can allow for those different experiences, right, and not be punished for it or not be ostracized for it or not be made to feel like they're in the minority, because they're not. You know, none of those little subgroups that I mentioned are in the minority. There are tons of social-only Masons. There are a ton of charity-only Masons. There are a ton of education-only Masons. And John, you hit it on the head where, you know, that you have to have that balance, and you also have to, I think, market better. You know, decide your lodge's identity as a group, decide what it's going to be. For the majority that all feel the same way that you do, or you have that, you know, that group of people that shows up, that 10%, for the other 90%, they're probably not even going to notice because they don't come. So who cares, right? You know, and that 10% rule is a 10% rule for a reason. But establish your identity, run with it, and make it that best identity that you can be, and let other lodges do what they want to do. Off soapbox.
Yeah, I think it comes down, Joe, to just that kind of old teaching maxim, right? Which is that you just meet them where they are. If they're into that, then do that. One of the things I think in a lot of lodges that we miss out on is the opportunity, of course, of enhancing initiations in general. And, you know, like you said, the observant masonry movement does get a bad rap. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but of course you don't have to be an observant lodge to take pride in putting on something, as an initiation, as defined as an initiation. I mean, I think everybody out there, regardless of like the social club masonry, regardless of, you know, any kind of masonry you're into, everybody seems to have this general idea of what an initiation is. And I don't think anybody ever thinks it's just, hey, you're in.
People paid your know, dues. You know, exactly.
They think about it. They think about it in terms of, you know, the Simpsons episode. They think about it in terms of, you know, their favorite, you know, science fiction or horror movie. They think of, I mean, not that these things are scary or whatever all the time, but there is definitely an element of surprise, of psychology to the entire initiatory rite. And I think if they just get comfortable, like, oh, this is real life and this is an initiation, which is a real thing, let's do it. That we would cause, I think, a lot more psychological change and bettering of Masons, and going back to what Joe said, right? This idea of it's not the blue lightning or the festival that ruins the Mason. It's us.
No, I agree. So now we get to the final question of the night. And tonight what we're going to ask is, we're going to ask you to pick one of the three phases of initiation and then describe how you would improve that aspect of initiation. You know, if you were a worshipful master for a day, or if you could help improve your lodge experience to enhance one of those three phases, which phase would it be and what would you do? And so I'll let you chew on that for a second, and let's,
can we have Joe tell us them again?
Yeah. So, Joe, what are they? How many and what are the phases of initiation?
Yes. So, the first one is the separation phase, or the preliminal phase. Then the second one is that threshold phase, that liminal phase, or, the threshold phase, I like to call it. And then the last one is the postliminal, or the reintegration phase. That's it.
Hammy said he'd like to go first. Let's go start with you, Hammy.
Sure. So, and that's perfect since I am choosing the separation phase, the beginning there. You know, one of the things that I've learned from visiting some other lodges is a way of separating the profane or outside world from our Masonic world. And some of the things I would do differently that I've seen in other lodges, but not in any of mine, would be The introduction of incense, provided it can be done, you know, for all, with all members, you know, because I know that some people cannot handle that, but something along those lines, the burning of the incense, to create that separation space there, as well as the addition of music in all degrees. Because I've seen that work well, and it actually, if the right music is applied, it actually adds to the experience and it adds to the separation. Again, the incense burning actually changes your sense of smell on the new environment. Because not a really big secret, you're blindfolded when you go in. So you really can't see. So you're having to use your other senses to figure out your way around.
Right.
And I would actually spend a lot more time trying to, prepare a candidate mentally for that. So
that's a great one.
That's how I do it.
Okay, over to you, Robert. Which phase and what would you do?
I think Mike brought up a lot of great points. And so just to be different, I think I'll pick the reintegration phase. I think that reintegration, we have a lot of opportunity to show what the difference is now that you are in. You know, what I might liken this to in practical terms is truly being welcoming and making a big deal out of this brother, maybe perhaps let's just say getting a Master Mason degree. A practice that I've seen recently, which admittedly was completely foreign to me before this, I had been a part of doing this, was this thing that just never occurred to even be a thing, which was after the meeting. Well, about halfway through the meeting, of the Master Mason degree, the secretary literally texted one of the wives of the brothers, and they were like, okay, cool. And then they all went to a restaurant and got a huge room, and the wives all hung out and partied until we were done. And then we all met them there. And then we all got together and had a big, awesome evening celebrating the brother and bringing him a reintegration, right? Like they bring him into the fold, and including his spouse or companion, partner, whatever, into the mix. And this was really interesting because, most of us, I wouldn't say, like most of, I think a lot of Masons have significant others who might not be super involved or they're just not into it. And that's fine. But like my wife is part of our, like basically what you might call a ladies auxiliary. So a few of our wives like make the phone calls and organize an event, and then they go out and they like basically pregame and then we show up and we have a good time. But just things like this, making sure that when a brother is brought in, they have access to all the lodge resources. They are called just as much and included in every single conversation. You know, having a master of a lodge with the foresight to say, you know, while a discussion is going on in a lodge, saying something like, let's ask our newest Master Mason, what do you think about what's going on here? You know, there's no right or wrong answer. We just want to know what your opinion is. You know, you're a part of this. And so all of these things are really key in my mind in a practical sense when we look at initiation and that third phase of reintegration. It's like bringing two chemicals together to form a new chemical bond and make something stronger and better. And that's what I think really what I love about it, because at this point, now you're changing the dynamic of the existing thing. You're making it better. And now you've increased your scope of influence of whatever organization it is. So if it's Freemasonry, now you have one more person out there who's walking along you know, this path. There's a story about St. Francis Assisi that I think I just read about on an episode of WCY. St. Francis of Assisi is decided to take one of his youngest pupils or whatever and say, hey, let's go down to the town and proselytize, you know, and preach to the town. And the new kid's like, awesome, I get to do this with St. Francis. And they walk through town and they talk, and then they walk back to the abbey. And the kid says, you know, St. Francis, you know, we never stopped to preach. And he says, we were preaching the whole time. As we walked, as we talked, people saw us, they knew what we were, they looked to the heavens for the answers, and they certainly heard the things we were talking about, spirituality and all of these things, and that makes a difference to all of those people. They overhear it, and they know that it's okay to be about those things. And so just all of those things, like, right, bringing somebody into the fold and reassuring them and changing the world. So that's my really long explanation of reintegration. I'll digress. But anyway, thanks.
So step three. Got it. It's okay. Good. All right, Joe, we've got an even number with three phases. So I'm going to go over to you next. Which of those three would you pick and what would you change?
I forgot my answer after listening to RJ there for a bit. Good.
Nobody likes you anyway.
Wow. Okay.
They love you.
So I am going to go with one, the separation phase. I was going to go with the third phase, but you guys kind of covered that. But I would say the separation phase, because I think we really need to impart to people that are interested in Freemasonry that above all, it is an initiatic process. And the more that we show these people that they're separating from their old life or their old way of being or the old way that they used to look at the world, the more they'll see that going through the process of initiation in Freemasonry expands your worldview quite a bit. So I think we need to take them a bit more away from their old worldview in order to give them a better sense of their new worldview. You know, and it's not, we're not telling them that, you know, after you go through this, you have to think exactly the way we do. But if it's done right, that never needs to happen, right? If you go through the process of initiation and it's something that's meaningful and emotional and that it actually feels like it changes you inside, then you do have a more cosmopolitan worldview of things. You are more tolerant of you know, your own faults and everybody else's faults, and you become a more well-rounded human being. And you throw away things like, you know, the way you were raised and, you know, the people you hung out with and the way that you thought the world needed you to be. And you genuinely want to be that better person, you know, the thing we put on bumper stickers all the time. So for me, I think if we make more effort towards separating candidates or initiates from their old life, I think they'll appreciate their new life with a better set of eyes.
Awesome. Thank you, Joe. Thank you for coming on, and thank you for nerding out with us. We appreciate it. All right. So I was going to pick step three, you know, reintegration, but I think just to mix it up, I'll argue for the second phase, right, of the actual threshold, because it is a critical point, right? You can always say, you know, before and after, but what about during, right? So how do we argue for a better case of making the actual threshold itself as powerful and in purposeful as possible, through, you know, the solemnity of the ritual, right? Many jurisdictions have the little add-in written in previous to doing the third degree that says no horseplay, like let's be serious about this, guys. And that needed to be written down and again passed around through multiple jurisdictions because the threshold was not taken seriously. And so obviously that would come with decorum, that would come with solemnity, that would come with a ritual that is well done, well rehearsed, and that everyone there is there to actually make that experience as great as possible for the candidate. you know, while no one's perfect, you know, one of the best lessons that I've heard, learning my ritual, especially to become a master, is, although the candidate's not going to know if you get a word wrong, don't make it obvious, right? And make it, you know, go with the flow, do the best you can, make sure that the intent is done, the best way. And then we can fix the literal words as you go. So, when you're at that threshold point, you're setting up, you know, this ritual for a candidate, make sure that the threshold is right there for them to cross over, and as not as easy as possible, but as profound as possible. So that's all I got. This has been a great episode. Thanks again, Brother Joe. And I want to thank all of you for watching. We'll see you next week. Keep searching for more light. Have a good night.
Wow.